This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Leanne Hansen. While there's been high drama over the federal budget this past week, states have also been struggling to balance their books and tighten their belts. New Jersey is going through a financial crisis, but one line item may be difficult to cut. For more than a decade, the state has been under court order to provide extra funding for low-income school districts. Now some state legislators say New Jersey can no longer afford to fully fund the school districts. Others say it's a matter of fairness. Nancy Solomon has the story.
In Newark, the Ironbound Community Center runs a neighborhood preschool in a gleaming new building that provides 150 children who are mostly from low-income minority families with a full day of learning through play.
No, I wrote it.
Some kids are working on writing their names in a small group with a teacher, while others play with blocks and another cluster is huddling inside a cardboard castle. Programs like these are offered free to all children in New Jersey school districts that have a high percentage of low-income kids.
The children play with each other, and conversation is always encouraged.
School director Grace Blanco says to qualify for the state funding, her preschool must have certified teachers, small class sizes, and a curriculum based on research that has found young children learn best through play and conversation.
Teachers talk to children, ask questions, open-ended questions. The children really choose what they want to do and how they're going to play.
Hi, guys. How are you today?
I just woke up from a nap.
You just woke up from your nap. I know that.
Without this free preschool, Blanco says, many of these kids would be in a low-cost daycare watching TV. And that's one of the reasons most poor children arrive at kindergarten behind middle and upper-income classmates. The National Institute for Early Education Research at Rutgers University has followed the impact of these high-quality preschools. Its director, Stephen Barnett, says New Jersey has made considerable progress in closing the gap in skills between high and low-income kids when they arrive on the first day of kindergarten.
There's no question you can make a big dent, and I think it's reasonable to think about eliminating half the achievement gap at the kindergarten door.
Nobody is disputing Barnett's findings, but the state's resolve to close that gap may be crumbling under the weight of highest-in-the-nation property taxes, which is the primary way the schools are funded, and massive cuts to state education funding that have hit suburban districts hardest.
Fact is, you know, it'd be nice to fund a lot of programs, but New Jersey's broke, and the Constitution does not require it.
Michael Dougherty, a Republican senator from Warren, represents a large swath of suburban New Jersey where resentment toward the extra funding of low-income schools runs deep. He's proposing the preschools for poor kids be cut to half day and the $300,000 saved be spent on K through 12 education in the suburbs. Dougherty says he prefers the way most states collect an income tax that then funds school districts equally.
But we don't do that in New Jersey. We collect it progressively, and then we hand it out progressively on steroids. So for every penny that my towns get, other towns in urban areas are getting $40. So you tell me what planet on Earth where that would be fair.
Shiera says these districts don't have the property tax revenue to adequately support their schools, and half-day preschool is ineffective because working parents don't use it, even when it's free, because they'd have to leave work to pick up their children. So Shiera says it's fair for the state to pay more for high-poverty schools, and it's money well spent to help children when they're very young.
This is probably one of the most effective education reforms we've done in New Jersey for disadvantaged kids in our poorest communities. It would be a tragedy if we now scaled this back.
Shiera is trying to patch a hole in a system that everyone agrees is broken. But changing the way New Jersey taxes its residents and funds its schools would require both political parties to agree on a fix and be willing to cooperate enough to move forward. And that hasn't happened here for a very long time. For NPR News, I'm Nancy Solomon.
Prosecutors from all 50 states are looking into allegations that banks are improperly foreclosing on homeowners. We're going to check in now with one woman who's been struggling to keep her home. She's among millions of homeowners who are threatened by foreclosure. NPR's Chris Arnold has our report from the fishing port of Gloucester, Massachusetts.
If there's a poster child for somebody who should not be getting foreclosed on, that would be Deborah Dahmer. Dahmer is retired and legally blind, and she's never missed a mortgage payment. She lives in a modest house with her 80-year-old mother and several very small but very well-fed dogs.
Louie, come on. Come on, Buddha, come on.
Why do you call him Buddha?
Because he's so big.
With her long, generous head of white hair and an easy smile, Dahmer's less than 5 feet tall and is the quintessential nice lady next door. And she even takes care of another dog that's disabled. It's a little black chihuahua-sized dog with some kind of nerve damage so that it walks all sideways and twisted up.
She has her own little bed.
She's cute in her own sort of sad way, I guess.
Dahmer hasn't lost her sense of humor, but the past couple of years have been very hard. NPR first reported on her case back in December. After her husband passed away, it was difficult for Dahmer to afford her mortgage. But she has guaranteed disability income, and she could afford her home with a reduced interest rate. And she actually should qualify for that through President Obama's foreclosure prevention program. But for a year and a half now, she says that her lender, Bank of America, has been losing her documents and dragging out that process. And now the bank has been threatening to foreclose.
Are they going to take my house, even though I paid the payments and always paid the payments?
Dahmer's been making reduced payments as part of a temporary plan that the bank enrolled her in. But now, even though it was the bank that told her to make those reduced payments, Bank of America has been telling her because she hasn't been paying in full, she's now considered delinquent and the bank will foreclose if she doesn't pay up.
I kind of dread waking up. I know that sounds awful. I know my mind's going to start thinking of this and thinking of this. What would I do? Where would I go? What would I do with my mom? It terrifies me.
Bank of America originally told NPR that it would review Dahmer's case and hope to resolve it within several weeks. But now, more than 3 months later, it still has not been resolved. The bank did enroll Dahmer in another temporary loan modification. But in what appears to be some kind of a mix-up, the bank at the same time has been threatening to take her house. The foreclosure letter from the bank is sitting on Dahmer's coffee table.
And I'm disabled. I stay in the house most of the time. I had to walk out of here one day to go clear my head.
Dahmer says she just walked alone for 3 hours around the town of Gloucester. Even though she can barely see, she just didn't know what to do.
And I don't like not being in control like that. But that's what I had to do. So, I don't know.
Dahmer has actually been doing more than just sitting around and worrying. She persistently called around looking for a housing advocate or a lawyer who might be able to help her. And she eventually got in touch with a prominent consumer rights attorney who is suing Bank of America on behalf of homeowners just like her.
There's every reason to believe that there are tens of thousands or hundreds of thousands of affected families.
Last week, attorney Gary Klein was at a federal courthouse in Boston for a hearing in the case. Klein is suing many of the major banks for stringing along homeowners. Wells Fargo, JP Morgan Chase, City Mortgage. Klein says all these banks and others are required to approve qualified homeowners for a loan modification within 3 months of their application, but often that doesn't happen.
People are getting the runaround. They're being told their documents are lost, and in many cases what they're getting is a decision that makes no sense whatsoever in light of their personal circumstances.
And are a lot of these people actually getting foreclosed on when they shouldn't be? Or
we hear from people at all stages of the foreclosure process, and we hear from people after foreclosure. People are being foreclosed on when they shouldn't be.
All the major banks deny that, but at the same time, state prosecutors are negotiating a settlement that would change the bank's foreclosure practices. In Deborah Dahmer's case, when NPR contacted Bank of America this time around, the bank now says that it has finally approved a permanent loan modification for her, and it sent her the paperwork over the weekend. Chris Arnold, NPR News, Boston.
This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Scott Simon. And the U.S. government is still operating this morning. President Barack Obama and congressional leaders struck a deal last night to avoid a partial government shutdown. With barely an hour to go before funding expired, word came from the U.S. Capitol that an agreement had been reached. In exchange for Democrats agreeing to spending cuts, Republicans dropped most of the social and environmental policy restrictions they'd sought to include in a measure that funds the government through September. NPR's David Wilna has the report from the Capitol.
It was 10:30 at night when negotiators say they finally shook hands on a deal to keep the federal government from shutting down. In another half hour, the shutdown would have begun, and some 800,000 federal employees would have faced furloughs. Minutes later, House Speaker John Boehner left a closed-door gathering of House Republicans, where he'd fleshed out the terms of the deal and announced that the government would not, after all, be shutting down.
As you all know, this has been a lot of discussion and a long fight. But we fought to keep government spending down because it really will, in fact, help create a better environment for job creators in our country. Thank you.
Boehner took no questions and left quickly. He had avoided a shutdown, but it had come at a price. Republicans would not be getting the $61 billion in spending cuts that they'd approved, but would instead have to settle for the $38.5 billion worth of cuts that aides say was the most President Obama was willing to agree to. Speaking in a broadcast from the White House, the president called the deal a worthwhile compromise.
This agreement between Democrats and Republicans on behalf of all Americans is on a budget that invests in our future while making the largest annual spending cut in our history.
It was also a happy ending to a politically perilous standoff for a president who's just launched a bid for a second term in office. But Mr. Obama acknowledged that he, too, had paid a price to get a deal.
Some of the cuts we agreed to will be painful. Programs people rely on will be cut back. Needed infrastructure projects will be delayed. And I would not have made these cuts in better circumstances. But beginning to live within our means is the only way to protect those investments that will help America compete for new jobs.
The spending cuts were a bitter pill to swallow for Senate Majority Leader Harry Reid as well, but he cast them as a good start for going after deficit spending.
What we've done has been difficult but important for the country. We all agree that there are many cuts that have to take place in the future. We understand that. We must get this country's fiscal house in order.
President Obama and Reid did hold the line against dozens of policy riders that Republicans had sought to include, efforts to defund everything from the new health care law to Planned Parenthood to National Public Radio. The House Republicans' insistence on including such provisions in the spending bill had drawn criticism earlier in the day from some of their GOP Senate colleagues, including Tennessee's Bob Corker.
It's powder puff. We've got our nation at stake. And we're sitting here, you know, yelling at each other, saying things we shouldn't be saying to each other that take us nowhere over powder puff.
Early this morning, the House gave final passage to a short-term spending bill that keeps the federal government funded into next week. It cuts $2 billion in spending and gives Congress time to enact the deal reached last night for the rest of the fiscal year. Senate Minority Leader Mitch McConnell expressed the relief that Republican and Democratic lawmakers alike felt at heading off a shutdown.
We had an opportunity tonight to decide whether we wanted to repeat history or make history. Had we chosen to repeat history, we would have allowed a government shutdown. Instead, we decided to make history.
But while the spending cuts agreed upon may be historic, McConnell warned Republicans will be demanding much bigger reductions in next year's budget. David Wellner, NPR News, The Capitol.
And indeed, the showdown over the government's budget for the next 6 months is just the first in a series of fiscal fights likely in the months to come. President Obama said last night that the tentative agreement between the parties to avoid a governmental shutdown is a good sign.
And it's my sincere hope that we can continue to come together as we face the many difficult challenges that lie ahead, from creating jobs and growing our economy to educating our children and reducing our deficit. That's what the American people expect us to do. That's why they sent us here.
NPR Scott Horsley joins us now. Scott, thanks for being with us.
Good to be with you, Scott.
And So what does this say about cooperation in some of the challenges ahead?
Well, as you said at the outset, the government is still operating this morning. So if that's where you set the bar, this was an exercise in cooperation. And for federal workers and the people who depend on them, that is probably what matters. But it was an ugly compromise and not really inspiring to watch. A lot of those federal workers left work yesterday not knowing if they would be getting a paycheck this coming week. Mm-hmm. And the fact that it literally was the 11th hour before President Obama could announce this deal suggests that we may have a lot of late nights to come in this new era of divided government.
And, Scott, where do you foresee the Republicans and the Democrats squaring off next? What issues? What budget items?
Well, the most immediate deadline that's confronting this government is the debt ceiling. Unless Congress votes to raise the debt ceiling, the government will run out of authority to borrow money sometime in the middle of next month. Now, the responsible grown-ups in Washington, both Democrats and Republicans, have all agreed a government default it would be catastrophic. It would be much worse than any short government shutdown. But some Republicans have promised to withhold their vote to raise the debt ceiling without some big concessions. So that's one fight ahead. Then you've got the battle over the budget for the next fiscal year, which starts in October. This past week, the Republican chairman of the House Budget Committee unveiled his plan. It includes big tax cuts, privatizing Medicare. No one expects it to pass, but it does set out the GOP starting point way to the right. And then finally, you've got the long-term challenge of dealing with the nation's debt and deficits.
Now, of course, President Obama said for days that a budget agreement was possible if both sides were willing to give a little. And last night, he said, in the end, that's what happened. Let's hear this.
Like any worthwhile compromise, both sides had to make tough decisions and give ground on issues that were important to them. And I certainly did that.
And where did he give that ground, Scott?
Well, you know, he accepted much bigger tax cuts than the Democrats wanted. They, as the White House said repeatedly, they met the Republican demand for spending mm-hmm. cuts more than halfway. If you think back to December when the tax cut deal was negotiated, Mr. Obama said that preserving the Bush tax cuts for the wealthy was the holy grail for Republicans. And so in exchange for that, he was able to extract a lot in return, an extension of jobless benefits, a big payroll tax cut. In this case, avoiding a government shutdown was the president's holy grail. The White House was very concerned about the economic fallout from a government shutdown. And as a result, he was willing to give a lot of ground on spending cuts. Now, that said, the White House would argue it's not just that top-line number, $38.5 billion, but what those cuts are made up of. And as we've heard, the White House is arguing the president was able to preserve some of his priorities, including money for Head Start and higher education. And, of course, he did draw the line on some of those policy riders that would have hamstrung the EPA or defunded Planned Parenthood.
Mm. Scott, as someone who has covered President Obama as president and a candidate, midway into his term now, just announced for re-election, are there any lessons that you see about his leadership style in these negotiations?
Well, he's willing to stay in the background when he thinks it's helpful, but he's also willing to put on the pressure when he needs to. There was an important phone call he placed to Speaker John Boehner yesterday morning when things looked bleakest that seemed to get the negotiations moving again. But he's adjusting to a new era. And as Speaker Boehner has said, all sides are sort of getting acquainted to this new era of divided government.
And Pierre Scott Horsley, thanks so much.
My pleasure, Scott.